Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a long-standing journalist, writer, and reporter on health, food, and the environment. And every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and well-being and that of our total environment, the health of our food, water, air, earth, the health of our communities, the health of our society, the overall ecological balance of planet Earth. Every week on Connect the Dots, I talk with different authors, experts, scientists, advocates, thought leaders, and just ordinary folk involved in different aspects and different facets of all of the things that we're connected by and through and that impact our health and well-being and that of other creatures on this planet. So on this week's show, I have a really terrific guest for you and talking about a really important topic, which are practical nature-based solutions and practices that can help solve some of the terrible issues and concerns that are driving climate change, hunger, drought, and all of the things that are kind of at risk, that you know, are the afflictions that are coming to us for sort of continuing rampant in large systems and lifestyles that are not really mindful of our planetary resources and balance. My guest today is Courtney White. He's the author of a hot-off-the-press's new book called 10% Solutions for the Planet. It's published by Chelsea Green, a publishing house for which we're so grateful that we've featured many times on this program. And, you know, as Courtney White, the subtitle of his book is 50 Low-Cost, Low-Tech, Nature-Based Practices for Combating Hunger, Drought, and Climate Change. Courtney White is a former archaeologist and Sierra Club activist. He dropped out of the conflict industry, as he calls it, we'll have to find more about that, to co-found something called the Kivera Coalition, a nonprofit dedicated to building bridges between ranchers, conservationists and others practicing improved economic and ecological resilience methods and techniques. He's the author of a prior book and lives in Santa Fe. But we're here today to talk with him about 2% Solutions for the Planet. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Courtney White.
Hi, Allison. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time and the opportunity to speak to your listeners.
One of the things that you say in your book is that we live in an era of big problems, and I think, that is such a true kind of analysis, and I think many people feel overwhelmed by the fact that there are these large systemic problems requiring, as we think, large systemic solutions, and yet they don't seem very accessible, and there doesn't seem to be much that, you know, any of us can do to sort of move change the direction of the boat on this. And as you mentioned, in 2% Solutions for the Planet, this is kind of paralyzing for people. So what you do in the book is you focus on innovative practices that can actually make a difference. And that some of them are things that farmers, ranchers, or ordinary folk can do. Can you give our listeners and me some examples of the kinds of things that you're discussing and think are, you know, could really be helpful?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe a little bit of context. The 2% solutions refers to a couple different things, and 2% of the population of farmers and ranchers in this country, which is what I see as sort of the workforce for these pragmatic solutions, for 2% of the GDP, which means that's just kind of a number I took a run at, meaning that not a lot of money is needed to do these things. And then finally, 2% of increase in soil carbon. And that sounds sounds a little technical, but it's something that actually is quite exciting. So the background is I worked on a different book for Chelsea Green 2 years ago called Grass, Soil, Hope. In my work here at the Kivira Coalition, we work with ranchers and farmers in sustainable practices, organic farming, the kind of ranch management that moves cows around the landscape sustainably. And in the process of doing that, and we're involved in some ecological restoration activities out here, which I can get into if you want, I began to look at the link between land management out west, food systems, and the climate, I mean climate change. And I hadn't really thought about this before. We've been involved in sustainable practices out here for about 20 years. I got started as an environmentalist in all of this. We're trying to figure out how to get ranchers and environmentalists to work together better, because they had a lot in common, I thought, despite all the fighting that was going on at the time. And in the process of working with ranchers on sustainable practices, looking at local food systems, thinking about grass-fed food, for example, I suddenly realized that there was a climate connection, which is through carbon, photosynthesis, pulling carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and storing the seed of CO2, the carbon, in the soils. So I wrote a book about it called Grass, Soil, Hope, which looked at kind of a suite of practices that put carbon in soils where we can store it and potentially pull down lots of CO2 out of the atmosphere, at least theoretically, through some practices that we already knew worked. And these aren't things, one of the messages I try to get out to folks is that we don't have to invent anything. We don't have to wait for some big technology to come down the road and save us from these big problems. There are lots of small technologies already in place, like organic farming and some other stuff that's in the book, that address these problems. So we actually could go ahead and get started with climate change mitigation, with drought management, with intensifying food production sustainably, with models of farming and ranching and water management that already exist. And in fact, some of them have been around for 30 plus years. Most folks don't realize the climate connection. I didn't when I got into this. Mm-hmm. And it was very exciting. And so I wrote that book, and then in the process of doing that, I found all these other stories that weren't going to make it into the book. So I thought, well, let's sit down and let's write these 50 short profiles. One quick example is no-till farming. And this is, in fact, when people say, what's the one thing I can do for the planet? What I tell them is we need to stop plowing the land. Plowing or tilling, when you turn soil over like that and expose all those microbes that are in the soil that give soil life and fertility to wind and rain and sun and heat, it kills them. And the plow kills them too. Actually, the plow itself tears up mycorrhizal fungi, which are the good guys in the soil. And then we start having all kinds of problems. And how we kind of get into industrial agriculture, because then we have to return fertility to the soil by chemicals that we've lost when we've killed the biology of the soil. So tilling, plowing, turning soil over is one of the things that has contributed to the situation. So there's a no-till movement out there, which is just what it sounds like. It's a way of farming without tilling, which you listeners might be saying, what is he talking about? There's actually a no-till drill. It's a device. They put it back in tractors, and it cuts thin, very, very thin lines in the soil, and it drops seed down at the proper length. And then the grass cover, plant cover, is there in place. You don't turn anything over. The seeds in the ground, the grass cover protects the seeds, the microbes, and the water stays, and grass grows. The crops grow. So it's a no-till system, a no-till drill. Now, it's got some challenges because weeds go, thank you very much for not tilling the soil, and weeds grow. And then so there are corn and soybean farmers in the Midwest who use a no-till system. that they also have to spray, which is not good. But there's now an organic no-till system. It's not used widely, but it's growing, and it came out of the Rodale Institute in Pennsylvania. It's described in the book. It's just it's a way of growing a cover crop and crimping it with a roller, and then that protects the seeds and the plants grow, and you've got a cover crop, and you've got your cash crop, and all kinds of cool things happen. So there's an example of a organic regenerative system that does all these cool things, including encouraging carbon sequestration out of the atmosphere through the plants. And so there's that's just one of 50 profiles that address a variety of challenges and do it with basically, you know, old farming, but done in a new way. So it's organic cover crop farming systems, which is what we used to have, with an eye towards modern challenges like climate change.
Wow, that's fascinating. That's just incredible. So, no, these are all things that small-scale farmers can do. Can home gardeners do them? Or, you know, is that kind of not realistic? Or, you know, what do you say about that? Or are they directed toward farmers pretty much? Or, you know,
Yeah, it's kind of all of the above. And so the book itself is, has different target audiences, and so it's divided into five parts. And so the first part focuses on ranching, the second part focuses on farms, third part looks at technology, and I can get into that in a second. There's a really kind of interesting nexus between some high tech and some low tech things going on out there. And then the fourth part is ecological restoration, just the idea that we've got a lot of damaged land, what can we do to kind of heal it and get it back into shape. And then the fifth part is about wildness, because I, as a conservationist myself, I didn't want to leave animals out of this. And then we get a great example about that. Dung beetles. So dung beetles, they're wild animals. And why could they possibly be important? Well, dung beetles, gosh, they roll up animal dung into balls and then bury it. And that does all kinds of cool things for the environment. It aerates the soil, it puts carbon in the soil, it allows water to infiltrate, it gets rid of manure, it does it all for free. And dung beetles are really an incredible creature. And unfortunately, they're very sensitive to pesticides and herbicides, and we've wiped out large populations of dung beetles in the country. But where they are allowed to come back, they become a very important part of the biodiversity of any ecosystem is dung beetles doing their thing. So here's an example of the nature has the answers if we allow nature to express itself. And so another chapter is about beavers, what beavers do, the positive things that beavers do for us. But to answer your question, so there is a wide variety of different places for readers to see themselves in. So there's a chapter on rooftop gardening. There's a chapter on local farms. There's chapters on grass-fed meat if folks are meat eaters. It don't have to be, but you know, where you eat, where you get your food from, how that farm or ranch produces its food, all becomes important. So I tried to kind of cross cut all these different things so that readers would see themselves somewhere in the story, whether they like wildlife or whether they are worried about. I mean, there's a whole chapter on aquaponics, which is how to grow food in your bathtub. So, you know, half the world's population lives in cities now. So urban agriculture is becoming very important. And aquaponics is a system where you can grow vegetables in a soilless system. Think grow lights and kind of a water mixture going around plants, and then it circulates through a fish tank, and the fish fish waste is comes up through the system, and the plants love it, and they clean it up, and the water goes back down to the fish. And so it's a circulating, closed ecosystem that grows a lot of food. You don't have to eat the fish, but if you want to eat the fish, you can eat the fish. So there's protein, and there's vegetables, and it's all can be configured to fit your pool, your bathtub, outside in the back porch, all these things. Anyway, so there's a good example of a a way to kind of participate in this right out your back door. So, they're short profiles. They're only 1,400 words. The idea was to kind of whet everybody's appetite just on what story motivated them to go and dig deeper. Wow, that's interesting. I never thought about that before. And then you go and you dig deeper into a story.
Wow, that's fascinating. That's really, really great stuff. What do you have to say about grass-fed meat from an ecological perspective? Because, I think we all know or have heard, and it's kind of assumed to be the only option, the vegan option, for its environmental conservation. In other words, we're not using up all of this energy growing all these grasses and to produce meat. I mean, what is you're saying that there is a counter, a way that grass-fed meat is environmentally friendly. What would that be?
Well, yeah, I want to emphasize that people who don't eat meat don't have to go down this road. I mean, I'm not advocating meat eating, but if folks do eat meat and if they are conscious about these issues, there are alternatives. So most meat is raised in an industrial food system, and so it's saturated in fossil fuels, in water waste, in animal waste. It's up and down the production line. There's all kinds of environmental issues involved in meat production. Grass-fed meat, on the other hand, is how nature wants animals to live. So animals who live their entire lives on grass. So think of a cow on a ranch, born on grass, lives its life on grass, and meets its end still eating grass. And so that's their bodies are set up. They're ruminants to eat grass and digest it and grow. Feedlots, which where most cows end up in, are not grass based. They're grain based, and animals are not designed to eat grain. So everything about the kind of the grain fed meat production system has a large ecological impacts, well documented. On the other side, we buy our beef from a ranch here in New Mexico that is very well managed and is grass fed. So it's it's local. The animals are on grass their whole lives, so to say there's an ecological impact there is a stretch, because these are animals doing what nature intended them to do, which is eat grass. Whether or not they become food is kind of a different issue, but their ecological impact is very small, especially compared to the feedlot system. The argument, people get passionate about this, of course, about meat eating versus not meat eating. I just would encourage folks to kind of look at where their vegetables come from. I mean, soy production in this country can be pretty ecologically damning if done on an industrial scale. So it's not really, to me, it's not about meat versus vegetables, it's about how the food is produced. Where does it come from? Is it done in a nature's model, whatever it is, plants or animals? Is it organic? Is it sustainable? Is there got a small carbon footprint? Those kinds of things. And whether you choose to eat meat or choose to eat plants, those questions need to be asked and answered. And if they're answered in the affirmative, then I think it's okay to eat that kind of diet.
Mm-hmm. Were there any sort of practices that you considered in looking into this and then found that they were not as great as perhaps people imagined or hoped or as their reputation, and that therefore you did not include in the book?
Oh, well, that's a good question. Well, I didn't reject any, but here's a good example. Go back to aquaponics for a second, because aquaponics is a blend of hydroponics and aquaculture, and hydroponics and aquaculture are big deals today. So hydroponics is just, you know, growing plants indoors or outdoors in a kind of a water solution. The classic example is growing marijuana, right? In a system that just circulates water round and round. You grow plants. Aquaculture is fish tanks, you know, big fish farms, either offshore or in big tanks. So both those systems have their own challenges. There's a lot of waste involved. There's a lot of water dumping involved. There's chemistry to keep things, you know, in balance. And so both of those systems have big challenges. But aquaponics takes the best of both. Both, for example, circulates that stuff around and around, solves all these problems. So those systems, like aquaculture, which is how a lot of fish gets produced in the world today, these big fish farms, that's a system that I wouldn't advocate for. It's not sustainable. It's not light on the planet. But aquaponics, which combines fish with that recirculating plant-growing water-based system, is sustainable. So that was a good example of kind of looking at two large practices that I wouldn't advocate for, but the hybrid of the two is very exciting. So there's kind of a quick example.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about rooftop farming? Because I know that during the time that I was involved in the work to prevent New York State from being harvested for fracking with all of the pollution and water pollution and everything that would have been entailed by that. Some people were saying, oh, well, we don't need the upstate farms that grow our food that would be polluted. We can, you know, kind of go to rooftop farming down here in the city, and you know, we'll right. be just fine without them, which, you know, given the volume of foods, I didn't think was very realistic. And so I have to confess that at that point I was a little kind of I kind of thought of rooftop farming as a kind of wannabe urban solution rather than as, you know, something that would really be viable in a bona fide way. But I may have kind of given it a bad jacket in that regard, although I probably didn't speak about this much on the show or publicly. But what's your view of it?
Yeah, and there's a profile in the book of Eagle Street Rooftop Farm, which is right there in Brooklyn. And mm-hmm. Annie Novak, who started it, is a visionary. It's a small farm on the top of a TV production studio in Brooklyn with a view of the Empire State Building just right across the river there. And so you're right in the sense that it doesn't produce a lot of food. It's certainly not going to feed New York, even though there are probably a lot of potential rooftops that could be turned into basically big gardens. However, her point is that there are a lot of unused spaces in cities, and if they could be converted into food production to some degree or another, then you can start contributing to the overall issues of where does our food come from, how do we mitigate some of these larger problems. And she would be a wonderful person to talk to at some point, if because she can give you the kind of the nuts and bolts of the challenges of trying to be a community-supported agriculture or CSA in a big city. It's gone well for her, but it's a small farm. I mean, she's limited by space. Although I know there's another group now called the Brooklyn Grange that has also opened up a couple farms on rooftops in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and it's mostly tomatoes and things like that. It's not a a big farm in the usual sense, but it represents some very creative and exciting thinking about how do you begin to integrate food production in urban environments. And so there's another story in the book about a farm in California that's not in a city, but it's very close to a city, and it's highly productive. It produces a lot of organic food very sustainably using compost and some other things. And he has Paul Kaiser, who's the farmer, has a philosophy about how we can kind of nestle small farms up against cities and produce a lot of food to feed them. It's a very interesting kind of idea. So you have, and I know in Detroit they've been looking at a lot of those open lots that where houses used to be, part of the kind of the downturn economically that Detroit went through, as gardens now. I mean, I know, again, we're not working at scale yet. You know, we're not feeding a lot of people this way, but the early kind of inklings of, hey, we can do that. Hey, let's think about that. And that's kind of what the book is about, is here's some innovative solutions to kind of persistent problems. And they exist at small scales, yes, but we got to start somewhere and make these models work at small scales before you can kind of scale them up. And so there's Boston's got stuff. There's the vertical farms in Milwaukee where they stack food production kind of straight up in a building. So there's a lot of interesting, innovative, creative stuff going on out there, kind of in the nooks and crannies of the country, off the grid, which is one of my motivations for writing the book, so try to get those stories out. I got to cough just for a second.
Yeah. No, it's great that you range over. What about suburbia or people who just have, I don't know, a half an acre yard or something like that?
Yeah, and now I want to make sure that your listeners know that it's not just all about food. So there's a whole section on ecological restoration, which is something that folks who own land can do. And this the story here is that I didn't realize how sort of beat up our land was. I live out in New Mexico. We have a long tradition of ranching and farming and recreational use out here that has been pretty hard on the land. It's a lot of this changed now, but a lot of this is historical hard use. But there's been a lot of erosion. There's a lot of sort of damaged creeks and rivers and that sort of stuff. And there's a whole group of people out here leading the way on restoration activities. And these are very simple, straightforward kinds of things that you can do in your backyard or if you own some land. And we've been involved in it as a nonprofit out here helping to educate folks about these. So there's a whole kind of way of looking at land. It doesn't need to be about making food, but it can be about restoring land to health and all the kind of things that flow from healthy land. So suburbia, I live outside Santa Fe, what we kind of call exurbia, sort of a it's not suburban, but it's not rural, or it's kind of in between. It's there's lots of land where we are that could use some help. A lot of folks don't know when they look at land whether it's healthy or not. I call it land literacy. We're kind of illiterate when we look at land, and that's it's not a criticism. It's just kind of the way we are. We've kind of lost touch with the land.
Can you give an example of that? I find that fascinating. Like the kinds of things that somebody that was land literate might notice that the rest of us might not.
Yeah, you know, recognizing signs of land sickness. So, you know, so we did some workshops where we would take an instructor and we'd walk out on a patch of land, and he would say, just, you know, what's going on here? What do you see here? And we'd look around, and if you can see signs of erosion, and you may not know what erosion looks like until you can get, you know, a little bit more literate, but if you see a small head cut, if you see some rilling, if you see soil being exposed after a rainstorm, or some kind of soil transport going on where you are, it's probably a sign of ill health on the land. Nature likes things covered up as much as possible, grass to grow. Out here, if we see a lot of bare soil, a lot of dry head cuts or kind of small waterfalls, they're the signs that something is wrong in the landscape. And then, like a doctor, you need to decide what it is to prescribe to, you know, fix or heal these landscapes. So land literacy just means being able to read a landscape, and folks can do it in their backyard. They can, or any park or anything, they can walk out and say, hey, if I were a raindrop and I fell on this, where would I go? Would I be going in a good way or a bad way? Is there erosion? Are there too many weeds here? Weeds can be a sign of problems, you know, that kind of thing. And back when the nation was more, had more direct contact with land, you know, before World War II, let's say, folks knew more about the land in their backyard, and they could recognize signs of health or ill health, but today we've largely lost touch, and so we don't know what to do when we have problems on the landscape. So, and that goes for some farmers and ranchers too. Some folks don't just think about land as a medium to grow food in, and don't think about the overall land function, especially on industrial scales. It's just, you know, it's just spraying chemicals and growing corn, not understanding the biology and the animals that also need to occupy these landscapes, that kind of stuff. So the whole kind of land literacy idea, and that's kind of woven through the book. Almost every story has some part of being able to read the land and understand what it's telling you, pro or con, about its condition, is really kind of part of the stories.
That's really incredible. Where would people go for courses in land literacy? I mean,
You know, that's a good question, and the quick answer is there aren't many places to go to. We don't have an educational system that really looks at these issues in that way. And I say that because I've looked at programs at schools out here. It's a very different way of looking at environmental issues. We tend to be kind of endangered species focused. You know, what's the endangered species? What do we do? Production questions for farming and ranching, how do you grow the most food or the most meat? The idea of kind of taking a walk across a patch of land and simply trying to read it and understand it, very few courses that I'm aware of that do that. And this all flows from the famous American conservationist Aldo Leopold, who in the 30s and then in the 40s was famous for taking his students. He'd take his students right out of the classroom. They go out to a farm or a field, and he'd say, okay, what's going on here? Tell me. You look around and tell me what you see, and then he'd try to explain to me what this is going on. And, that idea of kind of reading the landscape, understanding land health, took off and was a part of curriculums, I think, for a long time, but it seems to have fallen out in the last couple decades, except in the kind of organic farming world. So I think if you've got programs in schools or on farms that look at organic farming, you know, looking at life in the soils, organic life, biological life, I think they ask those questions. You know, so what, you know, is this land healthy? Is it not healthy? What can we do to make it healthier? Those kinds of things. But no, to answer your question, I think you'd have to kind of root around to find these programs. Probably offered more by nonprofits than maybe by schools. I could be wrong about that, but that kind of thing. So, yeah, we tend to be sort of species-focused and not process-focused, but I mean ecological processes, you know, water cycle, carbon cycle, nutrient cycle, things like that. So,
I think that's really true. It's a whole, you know, talk a little bit about your own journey into that understanding, because I think what you're describing there, when you say, I couldn't agree more, you know, when you say it's, we tend to be more, when you are individually focused, it's really hard to imagine that there's any other way of looking at things or any other value to apply or lens through which to look at things, because, you know, that's just been a habitual pattern and it's reinforced by the society and people don't even know how to think differently, and if it's mentioned, they can't even quite get their minds around it. What was your journey to that shift in perception, or is it something, you know, that kind of came naturally to you and kind of generated your pursuits and interests?
Yeah, that's a good question. Quickly, I'm a city boy. I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona, and I developed an interest in archaeology and some other things, not thinking a lot about these issues. I mean, I had environmental concerns, pretty classic, you know, stop the clear cutting of the forest, stop the bad mines, you know, things like that out west in college and after college. Things changed for me pretty dramatically in 1994, when some stuff happened in Washington, D.C. that threatened a lot of cherished environmental laws, Endangered Species Act, things like that. So I got active. I joined the Sierra Club here in New Mexico and said, you know, what can I do? Help me, you know, put me to work. And it was still pretty classic kind of conservation, you know, fight the bad guys, stop the bad legislation sort of stuff. And I didn't think at all about ranching or really farming kinds of questions. But then I met a rancher who was also in the Sierra Club. His name was Jim Winder. He had joined the Sierra Club to try to understand what the other side was about. And in the mid-90s, ranchers and environmentalists were killing each other out here. In the court, in the court of public opinion, it was ranchers versus environmentalists. And it was just everywhere, all over the newspapers, and it was terrible because I felt that ranchers and environmentalists had more in common than indifference. Fundamentally, when you really got down to it, you know, love of land, open space, wildlife, as opposed to the real estate developers and, you know, all the stuff that was really mining, that was really tearing these landscapes apart. So Jim and I talked, and I went to his ranch, and I understood that he ranched differently, just the way he moved his animals around. He grouped them up in a herd, all his cattle, and he moved his cattle every 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 days so that no part of his ranch got grazed more than once a year, and he was trying to mimic the way that natural grazers, herbivores like bison, would work these landscapes. They'd eat and then they'd go, and they wouldn't come back. And that's what Jim was trying to do with his cattle. And he was very deliberately trying to mimic natural grazing behavior. Grass likes to be grazed. I mean, grass in North America has been around for 66 million years, being eaten by something, not by cows, of course, but by all kinds of herbivores, antelope, bison, maybe even rabbits. I mean, all kinds of things eat eat grass. And so there's a relationship there between grazers and grass that Jim was trying to recreate using his cattle. And the key there was that his cattle, being domesticated, would go where he wanted them to go, and they'd stay until he told them to move. And so he was trying to get that natural herbivory effect on these landscapes through his management. And so we started talking, and I realized listening to Jim that he knew more about the environment than any environmentalist I knew, and that included me, because he could talk about this stuff. He could talk about the water cycle, the mineral cycle, and decomposers in the ground, and all this kind of stuff, biological stuff. And he's a rancher, and I thought, my God, he's talking that environmental talk, and he's grazing cows. And his basic point was that the same ecological processes that made land sustainable for wildlife also made it sustainable for domesticated livestock, the water cycle and the grass and that kind of stuff. Anyway, so it opened my eyes hugely. I went, wow, this is amazing. He's trying to mimic nature here with his animals. There's common ground here. So that's where we decided to start our organization and push. Mm-hmm. This kind of win-win, that we could have open space protected and produce food locally and have all these ecological values. So that's my evolution as a person, as an activist, from kind of classic environmentalism to, hey, there's a more holistic kind of vision here of land and people and water and animals that included urban and rural, because too often urban and rural just fought it out, right?
Mm-hmm.
I changed my tune. I don't know, what that says about me, but I was willing to kind of look and listen and learn. And other folks were as well, and we started kind of building what we call the Radical Center. Folks willing to kind of work in the center radically for the benefit of all. And it grew over time. As the organic movement grew, as all these other things grew, until it's picked up a fair amount of steam now, and is much more widely known, and there's more wide effect than 20 years ago when we got started with just us and little pockets here and there kind of stuff. What I come back to, Allison, is that so many cool things have been going on by different people on the ground for 20 years. It's all been kind of beta tested. the way Jim grazed his animals has been, he's been doing it for a long time. Other people have been doing it for a long time. We don't have to invent new stuff. This stuff's been around, and it's pragmatic, it's profitable, it's effective, and it has an impact, climate and food and water and that kind of stuff. So that's what I try to get across in the book.
Did it, I think your background is fascinating and that evolution is important because, it shows how important it is to be flexible and creative and open to the unexpected in terms of finding new solutions. The other aspect of it, I guess, that interests me is, like for you, it sort of comes fairly naturally, really, to speak of, looking at all these interconnections that, you're aware of and that you've been aware of for some time. But you said you grew up in the city, and, many people who've grown up where, the focus has been, and I would count myself in that group, are in kind of a more conventional, civilized pursuits where we tend to think of everything, sort of process it through the individual and the individual effect or effect on individuals, and that kind of is so prevalent as to feel normal, although we know that other societies have maybe framed things a bit differently. Did you come to that kind of thing through some other pathway? Because, you seem to have already sort of developed an ecological view in a certain kind of way.
Well, yeah, that's a good question. Is that true? Are there not solutions here? Can we manage forests in a way that benefits local people and the environment with ranching. When I met Jim, I saw immediately there was some common ground here. But I think just having that willingness to be open to kind of challenging paradigms, even progressive, liberal type paradigms, which most environmentalists would certainly consider themselves to be, and they are. But it's funny, the reaction from folks, including ranchers, has been, been quite hostile in some respects, especially in the early years when we got started, because ranchers and environmentalists had such bad blood between them at that point. The idea of trying to create common ground, trying to create some peace, and trying to talk about sustainable cattle management just inflamed some people who said, no, that's not true. To which I thought, well, maybe it is true. It seems to be working here on this ranch, and it seems to be working here on this other ranch. Anyway, so it wasn't so much about practices as it was about paradigms, ultimately, and I think it's really a lot about how our brains work, and we tend to pat ourselves on the back for thinking out of the box when we're really not out of we're just in a slightly larger box, and right. So I had to push myself way out of my environmentalist box, and other people have. I mean, it's been great to see some folks have resolutely stayed in their box, and it's been hard to take because it's kind of, to me, it's sort of old school kind of thinking. So it's really about paradigms and kind of closed-minded thinking, this is on a variety of fronts, not just one particular front, but just kind of thinking about, let's try this. And that's kind of what the book is about. I tried to show that, hey, there are these 50 different ways of kind of solving these problems. They do require some recalibration of the way we look at the world. Let's take meat, for example, and however we feel about meat, meat is something that has economic value, rightly or wrongly, but it does. And so that puts money in the pockets of ranchers, who then can stay in business and protect open space and fix damaged land and all the good stuff that comes from good stewardship. But they need to be paid. And until we can figure out a better way to pay them, they make a living off of beef. That sort of tickles the anti-meat crowd. And then I try to get ranchers to understand that environmentalists have legitimate concerns about things. I mean, there's a lot of poor cattle management out there. It's been my experience that it's a lot about just the way we think and our kind of preconceptions about things that really stand in the way more so than the practices themselves.
I think that's really true, and it makes a lot of sense to really, but it's hard to do. I mean, you've obviously evolved and made some leaps and all in doing that, so it's kind of fascinating. So your book, 2% Solutions for the Planet, which I'm presuming people can obtain that at Chelsea Green online, as well as local bookstores, Amazon, and other suppliers. It basically is designed to give hope because it shows a variety of solutions. Beyond the the ones that we think we maybe can or cannot do. So there's kind of something in it for everybody. What is your own favorite one of the solutions?
That's a good question. Some were very familiar to me, and some were new to me. Probably the ones that impressed me the most were the ones involving technology, and because we tend to think, when we think of food systems and organic and cattle and stuff, we tend to think it's all kind of low tech or no tech or old tech, but there are some young farmers, young ranchers, that are combined high tech with old tech. It's a very interesting way. So let me give you two examples. One of the chapters is called Farm Hack, and it was started by a farmer and his friends in New Hampshire, Dorn Cox. And Dorn grew up in his family organic farm outside Lee, New Hampshire, and went away. He was told that there was no future in farming, so he left the farm. He went into software and learned all the kind of stuff, tech stuff, software stuff, computer stuff. Eventually, he decided to go back to the farm. Went back to the farm, and he brought with him all that he had learned in the technology sector. And he has a great quote. He says that farming isn't rocket science; it's more complicated than that. And so he brought with him open source technology, software. He brought computing power. He works with other farmers. He does a lot of monitoring using low cost technology to monitor the soils and the plants. And then they link up through the internet on an open source platform and share all the knowledge. None of it's proprietary. He and his buddies came up with a new biodiesel process, and they put it online to share it with everybody. And the computing power, kind of shared computing power, allows them to crunch the data that they need to manage the farms better. It's just really, really interesting. And it's called Farm Hack, and it's like a hacker. And it's idea being that they're kind of hacking new ideas, sharing information. It's a forum for young farmers, new farmers. Anybody's got a bright idea, has a question, they get online, they talk to each other. But it's still about farming. It's still about food and organic and all that sort of stuff. But it's rather than having to kind of sift through journals or whatever, they share it all online. So it's definitely, the internet meets organic farming. And it's just really cool to kind of see how that's grown over time. Another example that I saw in France, actually, was really interesting. Some researchers, scientific researchers, were putting solar panels above farm fields. And so what they were doing was, in Europe, they have space problems. They have a space crunch, too many people, not enough land. So they're trying to figure out how to get renewable energy and food production from the same plot of land. And it was a science project. They were carefully measuring how high the solar panels could be and how far apart they could be to keep the productivity of the farm up. But they also saw it as shade for the plants on hot days. Maybe under climate change, we're going to have hotter, drier days. And then kind of how space things out, and then the farmer gets paid in the winter for energy when he can't grow any crops. So and their research showed that that productivity did not fall off very much if you do it just right. That the shade provided by the solar panels doesn't diminish the productivity. So you can have energy and food from one plot of land. And so there's a good example of not just technology, but science. This was a hard science project where they had a control plot and they were kind of doing all this stuff. Anyway, so that's a kind of cool, innovative thinking research going on here, trying to solve energy problems and food problems. Technology, old technology meets new technology. Those end up being my favorite stories, kind of the ones that that both look backwards at the kind of farming we used to do before chemicals came along, and yet looks forward to the latest in silicon technology or computing technology, or
solar technology, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what you can pack onto a smartphone now. I mean, God, be able to pull out your phone and figure out something going on in the farm is really cool. It's a little bit beyond my pay grade, to be honest with you, but it's neat to see other folks doing that. So that's, you know, that kind of thing.
That's great. So, you know, I think we're coming down to our final minutes here,
sure.
But, you know, but it's really, that's a fantastic way to end. Very uplifting, surprising, and really there's a lot to learn from the 2% solution for the planet, 50 low-cost, low-tech, nature-based practices for combating hunger, drought, and climate change by our guest today on Connect the Dots, Courtney White. Thank you so much for being with us today and sharing all of your experience and wisdom and creative thinking through this book and with our listeners today on Connect the Dots. Good luck with it. I hope a lot of people read it. It's really important stuff.
Thank you, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, that's great. Good luck with it, and thanks for all you're doing. And thank you, listeners, for being with us today for another edition of Connect the Dots. We'll be back with you again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. If you've enjoyed this show, pass it along to others. It'll be in the Connect the Dots archive. Like us on iTunes and dip into that archive to get a whole host of programs on all of the things that affect our health in Connect the Dots. Be well. Have a great week, everyone.